This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
For an insider's view of your favorite college and professional sports teams, there is no better source than Sports Illustrated. Award-winning reporting along with exclusive interviews. Always be up to date with Spotlight on Sports, coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome, this is Spotlight on Sports, and I'm your reader Pat with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Sports Illustrated, April 2023. And I'll begin with, is this what the future looks like? They don't sell meat. They don't burn carbon. They do have a solar-powered robot. Forest Green Rovers are the greenest team in sports. Owner Dale Vince says it's time for the big clubs to catch up. This is written by John Gonzalez. It's an odd spot for the future of sports, tucked away atop a hill in the English countryside, 2 hours west of London. Nailsworth is a quaint little town with a population just north of 5,700. Cottages dot the rolling landscape, bordered by stone walls and neatly manicured hedges and lush green trees with mushroom-shaped tops so thick and perfect they look like an artist's rendering. On the drive into town on this sunny but brisk October morning, a cow stops in the opposite lane, shuts down traffic, and refuses to move despite the honking protests. I ask our photographer, Tom, a delightful lad from London, who kindly shuttles us both out here so I don't have to drive on the left side of the road, thus avoiding an international incident, what he'd do if he lived in a place like this. I guess I'd play a lot of golf. Oh, do you golf? No, but you'd have to take it up, wouldn't you? All of which is to say that Nailsworth is not without its charms, but it's an unexpected place for a professional sports team that has garnered global attention. That squad, Forest Green Rovers, has dubbed itself the greenest soccer club on earth. And everyone agrees, from the big boys two levels up in the Premier League to the United Nations, which certified FGR as the world's first carbon-neutral club. The pitch at the Bolt New Lawn Stadium is fertilized with seaweed. There are charging ports for supporters with electric vehicles. Some 20% of the electricity for the entire operation comes from solar panels mounted on the stadium roof. The rest is supplied by windmills just up the hill and behind a bank of trees overlooking the grounds. The soda machines use carbon capture technology to fizz the drinks. The jerseys are made from coffee grounds and recycled plastic. The club is building a new stadium nearby entirely out of timber. Concrete is environmentally unfriendly for a host of reasons, and by next season the team hopes to train at that location. The cooking grease used at the concession stands is recycled, and the food itself, burgers, nuggets, sandwiches, and hand pies, is entirely vegan. Oh, and the hydroponic lights used for growing the grass on the pitch were confiscated by the local constables in a drug raid. Even they're recycled in a way. What else? We have one of those solar-powered lawnmower robots, the team's owner, Dale Vince, tells me as we tour the grounds before FGR takes on Bolton this afternoon. Just goes round the pitch, but we've had that for like 10 years now. Vince, 61, is tall and trim, with his head shaved on the sides and wisps of long sandy hair flowing straight back. He's wearing a black and white scarf, black t-shirt and tight black pants with zippers stitched in random locations. His fingernails are painted black, and he has a little lightning bolt earring punched into his cartilage. He's held forth today on everything from his excitement about an electric plane project to the various political controversies he's set off in recent weeks. Right now, though, he's telling me about a new technology developed by the green energy company he founded, Ecotricity, in which lab-created carbon is used to make diamonds. Evidently, FGR draws a ticket number and hands one out to a lucky fan after every home game. The stones are worth a couple thousand pounds, according to FGR's PR director, Will Guyot. which again sounds outrageous that this man, who has been described to me as a less wealthy Richard Branson, but who reminds me, too, of a slightly older but equally eccentric Russell Brand, is just printing diamonds somewhere. But then again, the jerseys are made of coffee grounds, and who knows where the snozzberries come from. He is a little like a green Willy Wonka, Will the PR man says. How is it that something like this exists at all, let alone in English cow country? And how have the supporters of this club, found 133 years ago, responded to a man who took over their local team and turned it into something so different? Some 3,400 people attend today's match, and they'll go home smiling after a surprising 1-0 win over Bolton. FGR got promoted this season to Football League One, two rungs below the Premier League, which was a happy occurrence, though the team has spent much of this first campaign at the bottom of the table, which has been less pleasant. They certainly seem to enjoy the experience with their vegan food and solar and wind-powered grounds, but I'm uncertain about whether they took to all the eco-friendly measures straight away. Like so many people I speak with in England, I want to know how scalable FGR's operation might be. Would it work in the Premier League? The NFL? Could this tiny club in this tiny town actually be a preview of a more sustainable future in sports? More to the point, what exactly has Green Willy Wonka built out here anyway? It was dicey in the beginning. A little over a decade ago, Forest Green was in bad financial shape. The club needed someone to ride to the rescue. Vince became that someone. He's a lifelong soccer fan who still plays pickup. He lives in Stroud, just north of Nailsworth, and the first commercial windmill he built, back in 1995, still sits atop a hill a few hundred yards beyond FGR's grounds. Years before that, Vince lived up there in, as he puts it, trucks and buses and things. He used a personal little windmill to power my life with some old train batteries from the scrapyard, so I was kind of self-sufficient. Vince grew up in Great Yarmouth on England's east coast. His father ran a small trucking business, but the family wasn't rich by any definition. Vince quit school at 15, tried college for a while later on, then dropped out. From around the age of 20, he lived on the road. Sustainability had always been his kink, still is. And by 2010, when FGR was in danger of going under, Vince had harnessed his passion to become a successful businessman. That first windmill he built turned into several, then many, and eventually he started Ecotricity, England's greenest energy company. After that came the Electric Highway, the country's first national charging network, which he sold in 21 for some £85 million. He's pegged his net worth at somewhere slightly north of £100 million. Not long ago, he decided to sell Ecotricity to get into politics, but shopping the company hasn't gone as well as expected. For now, he's keeping it. He still plans to be involved in politics, mostly through the creation of a think tank to produce studies for the government about becoming greener. He's already doing a bit of that informally. He went to the Tory conference in early October in hopes of lobbying and needling lawmakers. Vince secured a media credential for the event because he imagined that the UK's Conservative Party would not be thrilled about him attending. He's a regular contributor to the Daily Express on environmental concerns, and the outlet happily issued him a press badge, which he plunks down on the table to show me. When I suggest that now he knows what it's like to be a hated member of the press, he chuckles and says he gets plenty of hate regardless. In March 2022, a game between Everton and Newcastle was halted when a protester representing Just Stop Oil, the same group that last fall threw soup at a Van Gogh painting in the National Gallery in London, zip-tied his neck to a goalpost. Vince had donated cash to the organization, so he caught heat. He says he didn't know they were planning to interrupt a Premier League match, but he didn't seem too broken up about it afterward. He calls it amusing to be incidentally linked to the flap and says he supports the movement to stop oil exploration and production. That's merely one of his well-publicized controversies. In addition to a pirate flag and a green version of a British flag, the Palestinian flag flies over FGR's pitch at Vincent's request. It went up a year ago when Russia invaded Ukraine. Vince says that all things that were being visited upon the Ukrainians, the unjust occupation, the violence, the loss of life and the human rights violations, were happening to Palestinians, too. Many took umbrage at the way he linked the conflicts. Critics have labeled him anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic, or both. A group called UK Lawyers for Israel called for FGR sponsors to dump the team, and in at least one instance, had success. Vince says he is not anti-Semitic nor anti-Israeli, nor does he question Israel's right to exist, but he is critical of some of its government's policies, and the flag is still up. All of which is a long way of saying Vince is down for a cause. Forest Green was another outfit that needed help. Otherwise, it would likely have had to fold. He didn't want to run a football club, but he figured the team is in my backyard. I can do it, so I will do it. He took on the club's debt of a few £100,000, and that was that. Suddenly, he owned Forest Green Rovers. Which does not mean that Vince immediately won over the suspicious FGR faithful. He believes his performance in a charity match not long after he took over, between Forest Green alums and some actors from Hollyoaks, a British soap opera, went a long way. I came on and scored the effing winner with a diving header. The ball was down there somewhere, he says, motioning toward the floor with his palm. It was an epic goal, and you couldn't ask for more than that, right? He's laughing now. It's a fun yarn, and it probably brought him some goodwill. But epic charity headers get the new guy only so far, especially when the new guy wastes no time turning FGR upside down. Changing how the team operates to align with his principles wasn't just part of Vince's objectives, it was the whole point. He calls the club a rescue mission that turned into a massive opportunity. He was primarily focused then, and still is now, on three things: energy, transport, and food, which together, he says, make up 80% of everyone's carbon footprint. He has always preached that people shouldn't wait for governments and big business to lead the way. With FGR, he had the literal means to put his money where his mouth was, and his mouth was precisely where he started. When he bought the club, Forest Green was serving beef to fans and players. That made me part of the meat trade, he says. That was the end of meat at FGR. It's still the thing that the media want to talk to us about first when they come to see us, Vince says, and we've been doing it for more than 10 years now. They're still like, how can you run a sports club that's vegan and not have a fan revolt? I did not ask that question, not specifically, but I did wonder about the initial reaction from fans and whether it gave Vince pause. I don't want to say I disregarded what the fans thought. It wasn't that, Vince says. I wanted the fans to come with. But there was never a question of I won't do this or that if the fans won't come with me. I would have walked away from the club if I couldn't do this or that, because I couldn't be a part of something that I didn't believe in completely. So we set about making those changes, but in the process, we took care to explain to our fans not just what we were doing, but why we were doing it. And we tried to show them that these were changes that they could make at home by themselves. That messaging, how to explain sustainability and various environmental measures to the average fan, is at the core of what Vince is trying to accomplish, and it is a never-ending topic at the Sports Positive Summit we both attended in London in days before the Bolton match. Held at Wembley Stadium with the backing of the UN Climate Action Organization, the conference features academics and business people interested in where sports and sustainability meet, including top executives from the EPL, NFL, NBA, and Formula E, a Formula One-style circuit with electric cars. I think we can hijack, for lack of a better term, fan identification, says Brian McCullough, host of one of the conference's panels and an associate professor of sports management at Texas A&M. He's a big fan of what Vince is doing, specifically using FGR to make fans think about these issues. McCullough believes messaging is crucial. The tribalism of sports can be harnessed, he says, to get past the gatekeeper that would say, no, this is what the Democrats want. Or no, God will take care of everything. You can get past that. It's the Dallas Cowboys telling me I need to do this. And because Jerry Jones is telling me, I'm going to do it, because I am a diehard Cowboys fan. Forrest Greene is obviously smaller than the Cowboys, and Dale Vince is no Jerry Jones, but FGR provides at least a glimpse of how this might all work. Which brings us back to the food. Vince acknowledges that we did face a little opposition to start because food is a very emotive topic, and people can feel threatened when you appear to challenge their choice of what they're eating. But ultimately, when it comes to the concessions, he says, we haven't found it to be that difficult. He says the key is simple. We make great food. Vince explains, we say to our fans, come and try it. If you don't like it, you can bring your own. We really don't mind. But we're serving the food that we believe in, and we can't serve anything else. I don't hear many complaints. Before the Bolton match, a father named James Priest had just finished his vegan burger, which he calls very tasty. He's sitting at a table with his teenage son Sam and Sam's two friends, Colm and Dan. The kids are all tucking into vegan nuggets and chips, which they say don't taste like chicken, but that's okay, because they all agree they're pretty good anyway. Plus, Colm offers, the environment has really gone downhill at the moment, and I think it's good that someone wants to make it better for us. He's 13, going on 40. A lot of clubs have come through to tour the Nailsworth grounds since Vince became Forest Green's majority shareholder, but none have stopped selling meat, or equaled Forest Green in reaching carbon net zero. As Wimbledon CEO Sally Bolton candidly tells the audience at the Sports Positive Conference, we found that the cost of doing things in a more sustainable way is just more expensive. But what might it look like if one of the bigger clubs tried? On the day after the NFL finally put on an entertaining game in London in early October, a down-to-the-wire thriller with the Vikings sneaking past the Saints, and a few days before FGR faces Bolton, Tottenham Hotspur Stadium hosts an event called NFL Green. It's a gray, gloomy afternoon in North London, and about 40 people from around the world are here for a discussion about sustainability in sports. Welcome to the greenest stadium in the world, Tottenham PR director Tony Stevens tells us as we tour the facility. Spurs were tied with Liverpool last season atop the Sports Positive Premier League Sustainability Table, a ranking of the 20 clubs based on 11 categories, including energy and water efficiency, waste management, and sustainable transport. The stadium opened in 2019 and holds just shy of 63,000, making it the third biggest ground in England. Part of the stadium's appeal is making it easy for all those fans to get here. The facility is practically a corner kick away from the White Hart Lane overground stop, so you can walk to Seven Sisters Tube Station in about 30 minutes, and the club incentivizes fans to bike to the stadium. When it comes to sporting events, the most vexing issues for environmentalists are the ones beyond an organization's direct control. How fans travel to games is high on that list. The transportation of equipment and people in general is a huge problem. As Julia Paul, Formula E's sustainability director, concedes at the Sports Positive Conference, electric cars are great, but we still need the boats and we still need the planes to move the cars and the people. 75% of the footprint for us is this. There are no easy solutions here, but as multiple people tell me, you have to start somewhere. That's probably the best way to sum up Tottenham's efforts. Spurs still sell meat, but Steven says the club has seen a 50% increase in plant-based food purchases on match days. Like most teams, Tottenham sells a lot of beer, all of which gets poured into reusable cups. Reusable cups are different from recyclable cups because they don't have to be shipped to a facility, broken down, then refashioned into cups again. Instead, special bins instruct fans on how to deposit the pints they've founded. Tottenham processed some 27,000 reusable cups for the Saints-Vikings game alone. The stadium has partnered with a local craft beer company, Beavertown, to run its own on-site microbrewery. I can vouch for the Neck Oil IPA, which reduces the mileage otherwise required to ship in suds. There's also a Circle of Life component. Stevens tells us the mulch from the brewery is taken to a farm in Essex, where pigs consume it. Later, those pigs become stadium sausages. Tottenham also has an on-site baler for cardboard, and there are 7 eco-bots that supplement stadium workers and help clean the largest concourse areas. On the whole, Tottenham seems fairly far ahead of the other EPL clubs, not to mention most NFL teams. Some of those are better than others. The Philadelphia Eagles, who installed solar panels on Lincoln Financial Field, are frequently mentioned as one of the NFL's sustainability leaders. Most U.S. teams lag pretty far behind, though, and experts like McCullough complain that many have oversold their environmental contributions. It seems highly unlikely that any Premier League or NFL team will go full forest green, but whether it's even possible is an interesting thought experiment. They're great and they're genuine, but they're much smaller, Stephen says of FGR. The bigger the level, the bigger the club, the harder it becomes. Vince naturally disagrees. He thinks it would be easier, not harder, to implement FGR's framework in the EPL for the same reason so many others seem to think it's impossible. Money. For the world's richest soccer league, where transfer fees can stretch into the hundreds of millions, writing fat checks for fancy toys never seems to be a problem. Money's really tight in the lower leagues, Vince says. It's not tight in the Premier League. I think it's easier the higher up you go. Vince figures the proof of concept is what FGR has done. He points out that the club has reached an audience that extends beyond Britain, including 100 or so self-formed fan clubs globally. There are billions of sports fans around the world, Vince says, and if we can reach them and make them fans of the environment, that's a massive opportunity to change which way the world goes round. He's certain that his model would scale. To Vince, it's not a question of if you build it, will they come. The way he sees it, he built it and they're already coming. Ollie Jones grew up in England in the 80s, a stretch of soccer history perhaps best defined by Bill Buford's seminal tome about hooligans, Among the Thugs. A Sunday Times piece of that era famously described football as a slum game played by slum people in slum stadiums. Maybe Jones wouldn't go that far, but he'd agree with the underlying sentiment. The violence and the atmosphere back when he was a kid weren't for him or his parents. He didn't have a club and he didn't watch much. As an adult, he moved abroad. Now, for work, he helps governments with water management. It's a job that has taken him all over the world: Bangladesh, Nepal, Pakistan, India, and Ethiopia. He moved back to England with his family 8 years ago. They live in Cirencester now, about 20 miles from Nailsworth. Ollie's kids didn't have a club, but they wanted one, so Jones started taking the kids to Forest Green matches. Before long, they were hooked. Working in water, Jones was intrigued by FGR's sustainability push, but he likes the family-friendly environment the most. Lots of children attend matches, and after one of his sons won the local league with his team, Jones rang up FGR and informed them. The club had the youth team come to a match and lead the Forest Green players onto the pitch, and the parents all got their tickets comped. When it comes to local FGR fans, Jones says there's a mix of people like him who are into environmental issues. He describes Nailsworth as having quite an alternative community. And then there are others from more conservative areas, loads of people where this wouldn't necessarily resonate with their lives. And yet, as far as Forest Green's eco-friendly measures go, Jones says, there seems to be no real pushback among the fans. He doesn't know how many of his fellow FGR supporters have converted to veganism. He hasn't, but the food lines are usually long and the stands are mostly full. Jones took the family to the Salford match last season, and some of their supporters showed up wearing hot dog costumes to heckle the hosts. Everyone had a laugh. No one is taking it too seriously. It was amusing, Jones says. There's an appreciation of it. People recognize it. I don't hear too many disgruntled voices. I think people vote with their wallets, and they're still coming. Which is Vince's point. He doesn't believe EPL or NFL fans would stop watching either brand of football if franchises mimicked FGR. But then again, those organizations are largely owned by billionaire businessmen, not crusaders. And asking them to have tighter margins is blasphemous, given their devotion to making gobs of money. There's always going to be a customer who isn't interested in the environment and who just wants to watch their sports and not be bothered. As long as those very rich owners can get richer by selling that fan their cow burger and leave them to watch their sports, that's the path of least resistance and greater profit. Vince knows as much, though he doesn't excuse the big clubs for not doing more. He thinks they're content with anything that might get them positive PR, like the game between Tottenham and Chelsea in December 2021 that was billed as the world's first net-zero carbon match among elite clubs. Vince snickers at the elite qualifier because he says, they know we exist. We don't just have a zero-carbon game, we have a year of it, everything we do. When I push back that Tottenham has taken some steps in his direction, as everyone all week keeps saying you have to start somewhere, right? He allows that they are trying, and he says at least they're better than Manchester United, a club that was crushed in 2021 for flying its players 100 miles to a match against Leicester City. It should be noted, East Coast teams in the U.S. do this all the time, and nary a peep is heard about it. To Vince, that's indefensible. As best he remembers, the last flight he took was back in 18. When he travels now, it's mostly by electric vehicle or train. It took him 2 days to reach Arnold Schwarzenegger's climate conference in Austria last summer, where he delivered Arnold an FGR shirt. Bully for him, but avoiding air travel is unrealistic for most of the world, particularly top-flight soccer clubs. That's a point Vince concedes while insisting that everyone needs to do better, even Tottenham. Not saying Tottenham isn't good, Vince says as he sips a pint before the Bolton match. I'm saying they could be an awful lot better. It's not like they don't have the money. Have they got solar panels on their roof? Nah, I'm not criticizing them. They have made a start. Okay, so you're in charge tomorrow. What changes? Of what, Tottenham? Tottenham, what happens? Everything happens, everything we've done here. Stevens, Spurs PR director, wonders for his part what might happen in an alternate universe where Forest Green keeps moving up and somehow secures a Ted Lasso-like promotion to the Premier Leagues. Vince is amused by the idea and jokes, "We're coming for them, tell them that." But he knows that's unrealistic. FGR's goal is to play in the championship, one level below the Prem and one above where Forest Green is now. It's still hugely ambitious, but it's doable, he says. The Premier League, there's more ambition than realism in that. That doesn't mean Vince will stop coming for them in other ways, pushing the Premier League to do more on sustainability. The people at Tottenham seem to understand that, and they don't appear too bothered by his approach. Actually, Spurs employees have great things to say about FGR and Vince. Do they? Vince asks, a smirk forming as he presses his green thumb into the Premier League's eye for one more laugh at their expense. Well, don't let me slag them off in your piece, then. That's the end of that story. The next article is Point After, Slow Progress. Elements of baseball that have been treasured by purists are going to undergo some drastic changes. That sounds like a new take on pitch clocks, but it's from a 1973 issue of Sports Illustrated, when the American League adopted what SI called something revolutionary, something bizarre. April 6 is the 50th anniversary of the Yankees' Ron Blomberg, becoming baseball's first designated hitter, launching a half century of debate over rules and the balance between run scoring and run prevention. In a way, the DH set the stage for this season's radical moves. One change begets another. It just might take 50 years. Now a reading from Sports Illustrated May 2023 NFL Draft Preview. And we'll start with Draft 2023. You can't say anything about his size that Bryce Young hasn't heard before. Despite all that noise, he's been an elite quarterback at every level. How? The key lies in a centered family that nurtured him to become an exception to the rule. This is written by Connor Orr. Bryce Young has a body double. The guy is here on set, sitting in one of those tiny, unstable-looking director's chairs, wearing the same color hooded sweatshirts as his doppelganger, while Bryce throws a medicine ball in front of a camera. When body double Bryce is not here, he is acting in shows like Grownish and Snowfall. He has to give the hoodie back to wardrobe on his way out. His presence is one of the many little benchmarks that remind the young family that life is changing. Those changes are both unsurprising, given that Bryce has been one of the best quarterbacks in the country since he was in high school, and stunning, in that he is almost completely atypical for an elite NFL prospect at the position. The set is located at a community college in Huntington Beach, a few miles from the Young family home. Young started training here when he was little. He would throw a football so hard at the chain-link fence that the ball would wedge into the tiny openings. His training group eventually had to pay a few thousand dollars to get it replaced. A car company is on the clock for Young's time on this mid-February day, asking him to work out and throw and just generally exist in the orbit of its new SUV, which is polished and buffed like heirloom silverware. There are more than 30 directors, camera people, producers, set designers, and medics who chase people down for COVID-19 tests. There are enough organic protein bars and Uncrustable peanut butter sandwiches on a break room table to feed all of Young's future teammates, wherever he may land in the upcoming draft. Young walks into the cool California air and shakes everyone's hand as if they've just handed him an envelope at his graduation party. It's as if this entire commercial thing were just a passing cloud in his consciousness. Sometimes when a director asks him to throw a football, he jokingly lurches forward and heaves the thing at the ground as if he's doing it for the first time. His parents, Greg and Julie, laugh nearby. No matter what, they will be nearby. When Bryce went to college at Alabama, they moved to a home about an hour from Tuscaloosa so they could cook him Sunday dinners and help him get away for a few hours of non-football conversation. They will eventually be in whichever NFL city he lands after he has some time to acclimate. They are a proof of concept for how love can smooth the rigors of an inherently unhealthy process. Attention, the loss of a private life, and the birth of yourself as a brand in a business, Young has been living with those pressures for years. But now he is in the thick of NFL draft season, with its constant dissections and proddings by coaches, scouts, and media. His whole life has been about becoming something. During this process, he can hear, if he chooses, why many people think that goal is impossible. It's more than typical pre-draft poke holes in a prospect chatter. Young's size makes him an easy target for criticism. He's heard it so often that he just laughs about it. At the combine, Young measured in at 5'10" and 204 pounds. There are 36 quarterbacks in NFL history who have played at least 50 games at 6 feet and 210 pounds or fewer. 11 of them played in at least 100, most recently Drew Brees. Camp Bryce's position? When you play well at every level despite these doubts, who cares? The NFL's position, depending on which coach or evaluator you ask, varies. One longtime quarterback's coach says that he long ago stopped paying attention to height. Guys who feel throwing lanes and have spatial awareness, that's the gift, he says. One NFL offensive coordinator says of the film he watched on Young, "I loved his poise. He's so calm and confident, which is really important." One opposing NCAA offensive coordinator says that Young reminds him a bit of Chargers quarterback Justin Herbert stylistically, while NFL Network's chief scout Daniel Jeremiah mentioned Brees before admitting that there was no clean comparison. Another evaluator said that Young takes hits really well, making him less of an injury risk than another quarterback considered smaller in stature, like Tua Tagovailoa. Juxtapose those comments with the 24/7 draft news cycle, which has treated Young's height a bit like leprosy. There were sports books taking over-under bets on his combine weight. Before his weigh-in, he told the assembled media, "I've been this size, respectfully, my entire life." Craig is a skilled mental health therapist, and Julie is one of those teachers you hope your kid lands with at school. Once, when a special needs student was brought into Julie's special ed class mid-year, the child's occupational therapist warned Julie that the kid doesn't do a whole lot and was basically limited to cause and effect toys. She smiled, nodded, and by the end of the year, taught the students the alphabet, how to type their name on a computer, and how to sound out a few small words. Early on, when it was clear that Bryce was going to become a high school athlete, his parents taught him the difference between conditional and unconditional love and attention. Out there, when you throw a pass, when you buoy a program, when you win the Heisman, that's conditional. In here, where it's just the three of us, that's unconditional. That never changes. That needs to be enough. So far, so good, they think, though it doesn't mean they dismiss the changing world around them. Young won the Heisman Trophy in 2021, and after the ceremony, he went with his parents to a Knicks-Warrior game at Madison Square Garden. Steph Curry and his family invited the Youngs to hang out afterward in their suite. Julie says it stood out as a time she was really starstruck. When recounting the story during a break in the commercial shoot, she asked a rhetorical question it would seem she already had the answer to. How did we get here? The family tells a story about one day when Bryce was just a few months old, wrapped in one of those boppy nursing pillows. Craig would always drop a cloth football around the baby. He named the kid while watching Monday Night Football. He liked the ring of Bryce Palp, a Packers linebacker at the time. But this time Bryce caught it. It was a stunning reaction for an infant. That kind of reflex usually develops around the 18-month mark. Craig jumped on the couch and celebrated. The legend only grew from there. When Bryce was one, he could drill his mom with a football while she was loading the dishwasher. When Bryce was three, he was running pickup games with kindergartners at aftercare. When Bryce was four, he could recognize and read almost 200 words on his own. When Bryce was five, he was scoring on a regulation 10-foot basketball hoop. By the time Bryce was in eighth grade, he would greet almost every kid in his class individually. He was already famous enough to have YouTube highlight videos with remarks about his size so vitriolic that the comment section was disabled. In middle school, everyone is hyper-aware of their social hierarchy standing, says Danny Wu, Young's eighth-grade science teacher. They are either very insecure or trying their best to make themselves more secure than they really are. So no one is saying hello to anyone unless it's their clique, but Bryce could work with anyone. Wu said that once he went to one of Young's 7-on-7 games when Young was attending Cathedral High. The team had just defeated California powerhouse Mater Dei, and the first thing the quarterback did was walk up to the teacher and ask, "Mr. Wu, how is your Achilles?" They hadn't spoken in months. Wu, who had been recovering from an injury, was blown away that Bryce would ignore a massive achievement in his life to ask about a teacher's foot. After his sophomore season, Young transferred to Mater Dei. He was the first black quarterback in program history and spent one of his first spring practices getting hollered at by his position coaches. They told him to step up in the pocket. They told him to slide this way or that way. At a coaches' meeting later that night, Bruce Rawlinson, one of the most successful high school coaches of his era, who has worked with the likes of J.T. Daniels, Matt Barkley, and Matt Leinart, made a stunning declaration. "I said, look, guys, I don't know where Bryce is going or what he's doing sometimes, but every time he does something, magic happens. So stop. Nobody coaches Bryce Young. Bryce is his own coach, myself included. We're all going to be cheerleaders now because he's going to make us look great." That fall, Young led Mater Dei to a state title. When Young was at Alabama, according to one of his coaches, he could see the field so well that the Tide scrapped a lot of their run-pass option concepts, plays that usually lead to open receivers and easier-to-digest defensive looks for developing quarterbacks, and installed more professional-style reads. The same coach says that Young was handed a thick packet every Sunday that detailed the entire game plan for the following Saturday. By Monday morning, he had digested it and would offer suggestions for altering protections and adjusting routes. When the QB's time at Alabama was done, Bill O'Brien, the Tide's offensive coordinator the last 2 years, told Kevin Pearson, Young's old coach at Cathedral High, that the two smartest players he'd ever coached were Young and Tom Brady. As Young wolfed down lunch one Saturday a few weeks back, dressed in a black T-shirt featuring Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, and LeBron James, he was relaxed. He was reminded of the stories of his fabled youth and was asked whether he's bad at anything. "There's a long list of things," he said, eliciting laughs from his mom and grandmother sitting nearby. "Like? I want to learn how to golf," he says. "I played Top Golf a few times and I was pretty bad at it. Anything involved swinging, I'm really bad at. Baseball bats, golf clubs, it doesn't look pretty. So I want to get bigger into golf. I haven't taken the steps to change that yet." Day two of the commercial shoot took over the Young family compound, a quaint Spanish-style stucco home with cream-colored accents in Irving. A crew arrived at 5 a.m. to start covering the entire floor in thick, carpeted mats. Cardboard is taped to the walls to prevent scuffing. The living room is rearranged, new furniture is brought in, and sculptures are added to the table behind the sofa. Young's call time is not for a few hours, and for now, the focus is on Craig and Julie. They have hair and makeup done and sit for hours of interviews. They, too, are in the commercial. In a small moment of respite, when the crew sets up for a different part of the shoot, Craig turns on one of his favorite songs, Lovers Rock by Sade, and dances. They are, in these small windows, candidates for world's most adorable parents of an elite quarterback. They are constantly laughing, making fun of each other, and handing out compliments on how their sneakers match their outfits. Julie says they've been out to dinner when some of Craig's old patients have walked up to thank him for his therapeutic work. Craig says that having Julie help him see the world has made him a better therapist and father. All of this gets tested in real time when your son is born with a brain that processes like a chess bot and an arm that should be envied by military snipers. When you want to help him fulfill his ambitions while separating them from your own. It hasn't always been easy. When Bryce was in seventh grade, Craig had been coaching him hard for years, nurturing what they saw as a gift from God. Practice field conversations about certain plays, missed opportunities, or a lack of aggression here and there bled into home conversations. There was no way to tell where the coach ended and the dad began. Finally, Bryce went to Julie and said he didn't like being around his dad anymore. Julie approached her husband with an ultimatum. Do you want to have a relationship with him, or do you want to be his coach? And that, Craig says, hurt me to my core. I was dealing with my own stuff, Craig says. I didn't reach my own potential athletically. I didn't get the best coaching. There's a chance I stopped playing because I quit, and I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen to him. So if I saw weakness, or what I perceived to be weakness, I was going to yell it out of him or shame it out of him, coach him harder than I coached other players. And it was destroying his confidence, and it put a wedge in our relationship. So Craig coached himself. Instead of screaming, "Why did you do that?" after a missed throw, he'd say, "What did you see on that play, Bryce?" He'd ask the young QB what plays he liked to run, what made him comfortable in the offense. "I didn't realize how much power my words, especially coming from a parent, had," Craig says. "I started speaking positively. I told him there was no other quarterback I'd rather have in the world, no kid I'd rather be coaching. You're the best. I know you're going to make this play," building him up. "I wanted to make sure whatever he did was his choice. Do you want to work out today? Great. You don't? That's fine too. Just let me know before I pay for it." Craig brings up Good Will Hunting, the 1997 movie starring Matt Damon and Robin Williams. Williams plays a psychiatrist, Sean McGuire, who at the movie's climax finally breaks down the walls of Damon's character, Will Hunting. Hunting was a genius who resisted treatment and shielded himself in his intellect, in part because he suffered traumatic abuse as a child. McGuire hugs Hunting, telling him over and over, "It's not your fault." Hunting finally leaves his protective cocoon to search for happiness and chase down the woman he loves. It's a great movie moment, and entirely unrealistic. Greg's point is that therapy is not like that. There are no quick fixes. It's work. It's coming back to the issue again and again. He found psychology as a second career after realizing, during a sales call hawking digital cable, that he was meant to help people. He put his tools and his expertise to work on himself when he had to face his role in raising a wonder kid. He comes back to it again and again. Bryce would be on set soon. He lives a few minutes away now on his own. A representative from his agency asked everyone what they wanted for lunch, and Craig pored over the menu trying to select which type of fish and vegetables his son would like best. The energy would be familiar to any new empty nester whose kids are coming back around. My YouTube is the most random thing, Young says, sitting on a sofa on the second floor of his family's house, one of the few spaces that has not been overrun by the film crew. There is a corkboard wall with family photos, new and old, and enough shoeboxes to build a toddler village. It's literally anything. This is how he unwinds. Right now, he likes watching videos about ancient battles. I'm not even a history guy, he says. I've gone through all the Roman leaders and stuff. I think I just like learning random things. It's not hard to see why almost all of Young's coaches say teammates instantly take to him. Having a conversation with him is like resettling on solid ground after riding a roller coaster, which is ironic because right now he's living in a world that's largely out of his control. ESPN draft analyst Todd McShay said in February that the idea of drafting Young would scare me to death, despite noting that he was special. A few weeks later, he called Young a miniature Patrick Mahomes. Jeremiah, the NFL Network scout, said that if Young were 6'3", people would be talking about him the same way they did Trevor Lawrence. Pearson, one of Young's high school coaches, said he heard an analyst on the radio say that he wouldn't draft Young because I like my quarterbacks bigger than my kickers. I think even if someone has a negative opinion of me, they can still know what they're talking about, Young says. At the end of the day, it's an opinion. I don't play to win over the hearts of others. I play for my family, for my teammates, for the people who are showing up every day and put in the work. There's plenty of experts, but there are no experts who get everything right. You could get 99% of it right, but the one you got wrong, it doesn't mean you don't know what you're talking about. Young's favorite class at Alabama was social psychology, which, he says, helped him to self-reflect on how you're processing things socially, and also how others perceive things and tend to act socially. He called it really applicable. While there are some in Young's orbit who think he has harnessed all the slights and jokes and memes of him standing next to taller people as some kind of renewable energy source, the truth seems less exciting. Through this process, through an understanding of conditional and unconditional love, through his own explorations as a psychology major, which have helped him develop his own worldview, Young has tried to make the noise around him a non-factor. Rawlinson, Young's coach at Mater Dei, says the angriest he ever saw the QB was a game where the opposing team came out in cover zero, a defense elite quarterback can pick apart because it places almost all receivers in man-to-man coverage in exchange for more pass rushers. Young told Rawlinson it was disrespectful and put up 21 points in 6 minutes. Rawlinson asked him when Mater Dei could call off its passing game and stop embarrassing the other team. Young responded coolly, as soon as they get out of cover zero. When people describe Young, this is the version that often comes up. It's not a brashness, it's not a lack of emotion, but it's not an overabundance either. He can lose himself in a celebration. After he scored the winning touchdown for Mater Dei against the number one team in the country, IMG Academy, he shoulder-bumped a receiver so hard that he was knocked down. Or he can simply nod his head or flip the ball to an official after leaving the crowd with mouths agape. Young can talk with confidence about his own evolution alongside that of his parents, almost as if he can psychoanalyze himself. Even during the difficult times, before they instituted the rule that after 10 minutes of post-game discussion, he and his dad would deadbolt anything resembling sports, that helped a lot, Bryce says, there was something to take from the process. Like when Bryce was young and in love with basketball, he wouldn't shoot. Not in a Ben Simmons kind of way, but because he thrived on setting up his teammates. He liked to distribute the ball. I was the opposite of most kids, Bryce said. My dad would have to try and get me to shoot more. And it wasn't because he wanted me to be the star or whatever. It's because I just didn't shoot at all. I would always be trying to pass it. I think naturally that's how I am. It was knowing that he had the confidence in me, but he was also holding me accountable. He did a good job of those two. Bryce says of their relationship, the best part was being able to get over the hump of the fighting being over. There was definitely a change. There was a lot more time when we were able to have a normal father-son relationship. He says he values his family, especially as life changes, as his personal business grows. Bryce's college coach, Nick Saban, famously told an audience at a speaking engagement that the quarterback had earned nearly $1 million in NIL money before taking his first snap in college. And as there became fewer and fewer opportunities to decompress and learn about Roman battles on YouTube. Young says he appreciates his parents just being able to be around. We never talk about anything seriously football-related, ever. Our conversations are about shoes or clothes, normal stuff. Being able to do that, our interactions haven't changed at all. Their director calls for Bryce to go through his routine on the field. For those who have seen a quarterback preparing to throw, it's usually a parade of banalities. Little steps forward with weightless blue balls in each hand, waving them back and forth like one of those mannequin Neko cats. Half-speed shuffles and soft tosses. Still, Craig and Julie are watching, smiling. Julie is wearing the first pair of sneakers Bryce ever bought for her, a pair of Nike Dunks in Easter colors, pinks and light blues, greens and purples. She's pocketed Bryce's iPhone and chapstick for him, honoring a parent's most sacred duty, holding things your kids don't want to hold anymore. Craig is telling someone his next drill is called the Elvis. Bryce swings his throwing arm around and around, like the king singing blue suede shoes. Outside, the air is a bit cold. People are hunched over, waiting for the California sun. There is supposed to be complete silence. Bryce is facing north toward the street, toward the houses, toward the gigantic mountain range towering off in the distance. His parents say that if their son was a concert pianist, they would be at piano practice. If Bryce wanted to be a ventriloquist, they would be sitting in the front row watching a puppet tell them jokes. There is no formula. Great quarterbacks come from everywhere and nowhere. Some are troubled and some are calm. Some have idyllic childhoods and some are overcoming a tortured existence through football. Some have overbearing fathers and stage moms, and some have no fathers or mothers at all. Some come from homes and some spend their lives searching for one. But it's hard not to wonder about what is happening here. It's hard not to try to quantify it. Julie asked how they got here, and maybe it's simply because they never left. They made here wherever it needed to be. They never stopped trying. Instead of making their only son a project and a showcase, instead of treating him like a football robot or a piece of emotionless equipment, they allowed themselves to go for the ride, to be changed, to grow just like Bryce grew. So now they say this never gets old, even though they've seen it a million times. Bryce drops back, whistling a pass to the same quarterback's coach he's had for years. The ball doesn't blast out of his arm like a rifle so much as it travels like a drone, with its coordinates already punched in. It lands where it needs to be. Dad approves. I love watching him throw, he says. That's the end of that article, and it's all the time we have for today. This has been Pat with Spotlight on Sports. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.